Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play, which gives you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a 3-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows available only on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, and much, much more. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Let's start the show.
There, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and got a surprise for you folks. Today I have a special guest in studio with me. I'm eating up with allergies. Kyle Filson is standing over there with me today.
How's it going, folks? We've had a lot of storms blow in over the weekend, and man, it has got my throat jacked up. You probably hear me clear my throat 1,000 times this episode. I apologize.
He's been fighting it, folks, since we got in studio. He's been on death's door. I almost had to give him, I can't say mouth to mouth. I would just be like blowing towards him.
You'll be okay. We've been at a birthday party all day, and so we've been swimming all day. So as you can tell, swimming all day kind of wears you out. I'm beat today.
You're tired. It always makes you tired and hungry.
It does, right? What is that?
Because it burns so much.
But I didn't do a whole lot of swimming. I'm basically just sitting in the pool most of the time. Most of the time trying to survive kids trying to choke me to death. That seems to be a thing that they like to do. Let's all just pile on Dad.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the chlorine or the sun or the combination of all three, but you're right. Every time I go swimming, I'm like, man, I am hungry.
You're gonna sleep like a baby tonight.
Yeah, I think
it always happens like that. Before we get the show fired up, a big shout out to Mr. Max Holloway, the new featherweight champion, beating Jose Aldo this weekend. Crazy fight, really good fight. Jose come out on fire, put the hurt on Max a little at the beginning.
And congratulations to the Nashville Predators for beating the Penguins. Game 3. It's a good game.
I should have known that was coming. Anything to upset the apple cart of the Pens.
Yeah, but it rained so bad, we did not have our baseball tournament this weekend. We were supposed to, but now the whole thing's been rescheduled because of all the rain.
It was bad. There was hailstorms over in Mesquite. It was wild this weekend. But hey, you know what? It's that time. Hey, I'm okay with it, though. We needed the rain.
We needed it bad.
It was getting a little dry around the house.
And it's not that hot yet.
No.
For June, it is.
No.
is not very hot. It just seems like the last two or three years, the heat has just not been a factor.
Don't jinx it.
So I kind of like that. Well, let's get into the news, folks.
Hey, I got something here for you that you and I discuss often, Kyle. And it's funny that this popped back up. A guy named Mr. Starkley over at geek.com wrote this. And the title is Elon Musk, Automation Will Force Universal Basic Income. And well, I was like, what are they talking about here? You know, because for those of you that aren't aware, that was always a thing that was talked about, especially in the last few years, is a universal basic income check of where the government pays out X amount per month or per year or whatever, and you can spend it any way you want. And they thought, you know, if it's tax money, then we dole it back out. It helps to keep everything flowing, you know, the economy rolling. Right?
Yeah, I think there's so many people on the dole now anyways that it's going to be forced to go to that anyway.
Well, and this is what he talks about, and he brings up a really good point, not Elon, the fellow that wrote this. Basically, what went down was there was a summit, a world government summit in Dubai, and Elon started talking about some real big ideas, important ideas that's facing humanity coming up in the future, and one of those was universal basic income, like I said, where everyone gets a paycheck from the government in this, and they said that that's one of the only solutions, is what Elon believes, to the rise of robotic automation.
Mm.
That automation on large scales is going to change everything that we understand right now. And they call this term the post-scarcity economy. So I got to looking into this. Now, before we get into economy talk or anything, like, look, I'm a moron, all right? I don't know anything about all that stuff. I understand a little bit how it works. But basically what they're talking about is you can only charge for things that are rare. Food is rare, certain clothes. That's how the things work, supply and demand. You can't charge people for air because it's always there, you know, and that's what he writes about. It's easy to do, things like that. But what he starts talking about is when people start getting their jobs taken and – like we've discussed in the past, self-driving cars. They believe right now, as it sits, it's likely to take away 20% of all the jobs that involve automotive driving, as far as trucks, like 18-wheelers, delivery trucks, buses, trains, anything along those lines. I'm assuming probably going to planes before long, but anything that lies there, let's just say stick to self-driving on the ground at least. All that, they say, would go away almost instantaneously, 20% gone. And that employs a lot of people, because what you don't think about isn't just the bus drivers, but the people that work for other things along those lines that they're going to end up automating along the way. So right, people that repair buses, mechanics, well, then that becomes automated eventually. These things start snowballing. What they're talking about is you start thinking about you're going to have a rise of 30 to 40% total in unemployment.
Yeah.
And that's where he it's bad. And that's where he starts talking about this universal basic income is the that's going to end up lawyers. Robots are going to replace things. They said even a doctor or a lawyer could eventually be replaced with robotics in the future. But when they talk about the future, they're not even talking like 200 years. We're talking 30, 40 years from right now. This is something that we are going to have to face. So that's why he brings that part up, as he's like, do we draw the line and go, look, we're going to pass laws to where robots can't drive on the road. They can only drive in, you know, they can't deliver 18-wheelers, but they can drive buses. Are we, you know, where are we going to draw the line so we keep our economy intact? Or is it going to be the basic income payment is going to be what everyone gets because there's going to be such a high unemployment rate?
Right, yeah.
So that's something that, like we always talk about, and Kyle and I laugh about, and we do it with y'all all the time, is the rise of the robots, the rise of the machines and all this stuff. But there's so much more, like the crack in the levee, that if you don't stop it, it just builds and builds and builds till it's a runaway. And I believe that, knowing how human beings are, we don't do anything until it's too late and we have to go back and fix it.
Yeah,
we're not
right.
Real proactive. So you already know, without any problem, we're going to ruin a lot of lives and a lot of careers because of automation before we get it all worked out.
Yeah, I think they're already using driverless semis in Australia, at least in the interior.
They're also using robotic police officers in Dubai.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, they're starting to use that. So they're already dabbling a little bit. And I understand through the interior is probably a dangerous and a painful place to drive, as far as it's boring, you know, and it's for the human being to sit there and do all, it's monotonous and mind numbing. I'm sure it's a pain to drive. So automated, that's a good thing. But driving around, but it doesn't stop. And unless we find a way to make it stop, our whole economy, not just the U.S., the global economy is going to suffer due to automated robotics, as far as just that's in one thing, the driving. That's not talking about, like we talked about self-checkout. You and I have talked about that offline numerous times. Is that was a way that they've been testing it in as far as in like Walmarts and
retail stores.
Yeah, is self-checkout. Before long, it will end up turning into where that's all it is.
I think you're right. Sticking with technology, if you follow the show on Twitter or Facebook, then you already saw this article. I tweeted it and Facebooked it earlier this week. It's about the world's largest airplane is rolled out.
Uh-oh.
It's called the Stratolaunch, which is designed to release rockets that will carry satellites into space. It has a 385-foot wingspan. It features six engines used by the Boeing 747. It stands 50 feet tall and can carry more than 500,000 pounds of payload. It also has 28 wheels, Cam. This twin-fuselaged aircraft, the baby of Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, was pulled out of its Mojave Air and Spaceport hangar in California to begin fueling tests, the first of many ground tests, they say. Now, Gene Floyd, Stratolaunch's chief executive officer, said the goal is to have a launch demonstration as early as 2019. Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be actively conducting ground and flight line testing at the Mojave Air and Spaceport. This is a first-of-its-kind aircraft, so we're going to be diligent throughout testing and continue to prioritize the safety of our pilots, crew, and staff. While Stratolaunch has the biggest wingspan, the six-engine Antonov AN-225 cargo jet, which originally was designed to carry a Soviet version of the space shuttle, is actually longer. They say the Stratolaunch is 238 feet long, while the length of the AN-225 is about 275 feet. Also, aviation mogul Howard Hughes, remember his legendary H-4 Spruce Goose, which only flew once in 1947, has an enormous wingspan of only 320 feet, not as wide as the Stratolaunch. So this thing's bigger. Now, Allen, owner of the NBA's Portland Trailblazers and the NFL's Seattle Seahawks, has written about his desire to see more use of low Earth orbit without breaking the bank. He says, with aircraft-like operations, our reusable launch platform will significantly reduce the long wait times traditionally experienced between the construction of a satellite and the opportunity to launch it into space. Stratolaunch will take off from a runway. It will fly to the approximate cruising altitude of a commercial airliner before launching a launch vehicle. As the launch vehicle rockets into orbit, Stratolaunch will fly back to the runway landing for reloading, refueling, and reuse. Now, Allen's Vulcan Aerospace has worked with the aerospace pioneer Bert Rutan's company called Scaled Composites on this ambitious project. It says the duo collaborated on the launch of the Spaceship One back in 2004. I remember that. Allen isn't the only U.S. billionaire with dreams and pockets big enough to take on space. Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, and, like you were talking about, Elon Musk, the Tesla and SpaceX CEO, have distinguished themselves as much watch innovators pushing hardest to bring the future to us today. Now, I remember just a couple weeks ago, remember I sent you that video of the SpaceX rocket that launched and was able to land again? So that's pretty cool. It says, but their focus, Elon and Jeff Bezos, their focus is to try to get passengers, like tourists, into space. That's their goal.
I couldn't believe, when you were saying this, I had to pull this up.
You see how big it is?
The max takeoff weight. You can launch this thing. Will fly. Will take off and fly with 1.3 million pounds. That's the max takeoff.
Isn't that incredible?
That is unbelievable,
man. That's what I'm saying,
dude. This is. I can't quit staring at it. I honestly can't quit looking at this plane. I want one of those in like the models like you used to be. I want one of those in a model. I'd like to have one of those things.
I just couldn't imagine seeing the thing live.
Yeah, I'd like to go. I would, if it was around here, I would love to go witness the size of that thing.
So I can't wait to watch some videos upcoming this summer of them flying. Actually using it.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it flying. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Well, I got you something that you're not going to like here. I did a little digging in the dark webs and came across a website called Cryptozoology News. And on this website, there's a man claims grandma's home was damaged by Bigfoot.
Oh, no.
A man from Oregon claims his grandmother's house was damaged by Bigfoot. Now, the man, it says here, who didn't reveal his name, told a fellow named David Booger last Friday that the woman's house was located near Niagara and that two hairy creatures smashed it to pieces. says the story, told in some sort of legend-like narrative, but claimed by the man is real. All of this allegedly took place in 1964.
Okay.
It says it all began with whistles. And this fella goes on to tell the story that these creatures were whistling at the woman while she was working in the garden. And I'm going to give you some quotes here. It says, "At first I was caught by surprise, of course, but just like me, I yelled out, 'Thank you,' the man claims." His grandmother told him this, you know, that's what she says happened. "I was not afraid of the whistler at first. I figured it was a neighbor or even a hiker passing through just out of sight. But who could see me? I waved for the fun of it and continued my chores." Now, the fella says that the sounds, you know, continued throughout the summer until the event was when this woman noticed some odd footprints. And she says that they were huge, and I mean really big, twice the size of my own when I stepped into one. Had to be at least 17 to 18 inches long. Now, it says, as with all alleged Bigfoot stories, one thing led to another. As it turned out, they were also friends with the sheriff and called him over to investigate these footprints and what went on. And said the officer believed this ruckus was caused by a pair of homeless people.
With giant feet,
homeless people. And this fella says that the officer told his grandmother to keep her gun ready. Says, "I decided at the point to have the sheriff out again and let him know that I will be shooting first from here on out," she is quoted as saying jokingly. But the whistles and the fun came to an end when the sounds became more of a gibberish talk, Philly. She says, "I was laying down for bed one night when it started."
What does it sound like? You know,
and that's what it says. Listen, the trailer was one of those newer, fancier ones I got. The walls, however, were pretty thin, to tell you the truth. I swear sometimes I could hear the crickets outside, even when the windows in the place was locked up for the night. Now, she says, reportedly, now possibly forgetting that you can hear the crickets outside of this of a cement home, she says, but the gibberish turned into some type of Japanese.
Yeah, see?
Just like the state trooper, you know, that had talked about in one of the stories, talks about hearing. And it says that she said that she couldn't understand what they were saying. Now, the story goes that she could hear the two creatures outside talking. So she grabs her gun. She goes outside to tell them to get out of here. And she said, "Get out of here or I'm going to shoot." And she saw these things, and she described them as being tall and heavy, very much like real people, but she could tell that they were not people. So she decided to start shooting at these things. She said, "I lifted my gun just over its head and pulled the trigger. They were gone. In the blink of an eye, they were gone up the ravine and back up in the mountains." She said a few nights later, the creatures came back and started tearing up the house. She says, "They were mad, I supposed. Mad I shot at them. Maybe, I don't know." It was mid-October, the windows were smashed, the trailer was shaken so strongly that family pictures fell off the walls, off of furniture and the tables that she had it on. And she also says that these creatures peeked through bedroom windows. Now, fearing to get attacked on this account of her previous shooting, she decided to use her shotgun again and hit one of the creatures. And this is it. "I know I hit it. It turned and ran quicker and faster than anything or anyone I'd ever seen run. And it let out a scream as it did." Now, this fella telling the story goes on to say that his grandmother told the sheriff about her shooting these human-like creatures, and the officer believed her, but that, surprisingly, the man's parents didn't buy the story. So her children, this fella's, you know, mom and dad,
right,
didn't believe it. And to this day, he says that they still don't believe me of what the whole thing went down. So the story is, the grandson tells this story that his grandma was getting whistled at by two Bigfoot.
Right.
And I guess cat calling whistles. You know, I don't know what the... Then they show up to her house one evening talking Japanese gibberish, like we've talked about.
Looking in the windows.
She takes out the shotgun, lets one go. They scare them off. They come back mad, beat the windows out. Now, the picture they have online is of an Airstream travel trailer. I'm assuming when she says trailer that's what she's talking about.
Right.
She's staying in this little travel
trailer.
Not
a manufactured home.
Exactly.
Right. I got you.
So they beat it in pretty good, smashed it all up pretty good. But the guy goes on. That's where it is. She shot it when it ran off. That's where the story stops, man. So I don't know. But he says that his family still does not believe him, that's what happened to his grandmother, and his grandmother told him the story, and they didn't believe her when she told the story, the whole thing.
That is pretty
crazy.
Creepy, right? And crazy.
Yeah.
Speaking of creepy and crazy, there's a cool story over here, Lon posted over here on Phantoms and Monsters, about a Bronx monster tale.
Oh, all right.
Check this out. It says, a few years back in 2011 or so, I was living in the Bronx. My mom and I were outside having yarns and laughs. when she heard this strange noise. It's what sounded like an aircraft or flying object cutting through the air. At first, I thought she was just joking, until I heard it. He was like, "Look, baby, it looks like a bat." I was like, "That's too big to be a bat." Then she was like, "Well, it must be the weather balloon." She then walks back in the house strangely, so I sat at the back, waiting for her to come back out. She came back with coffee, when I heard something cutting through the treetops. Whatever it was had landed in my neighbor's tree. It had been cut back a lot, but had enough leaves covering it. It had a big thump to it when it landed. My mom ran inside when she heard it. I was freaking out, but couldn't help but stare. As I walked to the fence, I noticed that there was no wind whatsoever. As I was trying to get a better look, a big, deep breath blew into my face. I was startled. I stood back and said, "If you're a man of God, show your face now. But if not, just leave, please." As I was stepping back, I saw it. Shocked, like a stunned mullet, this big wind roared up, and with a huge thump, it flew into midair. Damn, that thing looked just like Jeepers Creepers. Big, tall, a dark-looking man, bigly built, a solid body, 7 to 8 foot tall, and it looked like it had wings like a bat. Shocked, I ran into the house and went directly to my room. I laid down thinking about what I had just witnessed. The next morning, my mom left to go to work, so I decided to rake the backyard. Then my neighbor yelled, "Hey, sis, what happened to you last night?" He then said, "You're lucky that it didn't take you." He went on about an old folktale that there was a man with wings like a bat that used to come around every now and then. He used to take women back to where he lived and makes them his wives. The way he described it, it's exactly what I saw. Until this day, I don't know for sure what or who the thing was. So what do you think about that?
It sounds just like Jeepers Creepers.
It sounds exactly like Jeepers Creepers.
That is so no thank you, sir. I am out on all that.
Well, this happened back in 2011, but don't forget that recently there's been a bunch of sightings in Chicago.
And he keeps posting about them. Like, if you're in, you can go and keep updates with what's going on in Chicago on the reg now.
I saw another one that just was posted like yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like whatever's happening, it's ramping up in Chicago.
More and more people are seeing it, yes.
Man, I don't know what to think about that.
But I don't want to see it.
No, definitely not.
I'm out.
It's a harbinger of death and destruction.
Right. My niece is up there right now for work, and I've been telling her, if you get a chance, keep an eye out up there. I want to tell you, if you see it, let me know what you think about it.
Right, flying humanoids, winged beast, mothman, man birds, gargoyles, whatever these things are.
I like ice cream and hugs, baby. I'm out on all the creepy stuff.
Right, speaking of creepy, after the break, I'm going to be talking about something creepy. You know, all the time on this show, we talk about UFOs and crashes. Well, I've got a new one I found out about. It took place in Wales. It's called the Berwyn Incident. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Over the years on this show, as well as Expanded Perspectives Elite, I've brought up many alleged UFO crashes, including the famous crash at Roswell, New Mexico, the crash at Dalnogorsk in far eastern Russia, as well as the crash at Cape Girardeau. On today's show, I'll be bringing up another famed UFO crash that happened on a mountain near a small Welsh town. It has come to be known as the Berwyn Incident. The Berwyn Mountains run southwest to northeast across central North Wales, separating Shropshire from the Snowdonian National Park. Local folklore tells us that these peaks have been haunted by a multitude of aerial phenomena, including the spectral hounds of hell, phantom bombers, ghosts, lake monsters, Sasquatch, and big cats. Although popular as a tourist destination in summer, the Berwyn Mountains can be highly dangerous, and mountain rescue teams are frequently called out to search for the lost and injured. The highest peak, Cater Berwyn, rises 827 meters, and several airplanes, both military and civilian, have crashed on its slopes in poor visibility over the past 50 years. In winter, the area is especially remote, often snow-covered, and dark for over 12 hours a day, an ideal spot, if there ever was one, for a UFO landing. It is against this backdrop that an incident took place on January 23, 1974, which at first perplexed locals and later the UFO community. The events spawned a cascade of rumors, which has led some UFO investigators to conclude that an extraterrestrial craft crashed on Cater Berwyn. These same ufologists also claimed that the alien crew, some still living, were immediately whisked off to a secret military installation in the south of England for study, and that the whole fantastic business has been hushed up by the United Kingdom's government. The Berwyn Mountain incident has been described as the best example of a UFO retrieval in Britain and likened to the Roswell and Rendlesham events. The Berwyn incident, far from proven, was a kaleidoscope of rumors and facts concerning crashed UFOs, alien bodies, military retrieval teams, earth tremors, meteorites, weapon testing, disinformation agents, men in black, and geologically created lights. The story is a complex one, so let's begin. Prior to the Berwyn incident, the north of England had been plagued by an aerial phenomenon dubbed phantom helicopters. Over 100 good sightings were made of this anomalous object, which was seen flying low at night, often over dangerous terrain and in extremely bad weather when most helicopters refused to fly. These sightings largely took place between the spring of 1973 and the spring of 1974 and ceased, coincidentally or curiously, immediately after the Berwyn incident. Despite the numerous sightings and the keen police interest, which led to a still-secret official report, no one explanation was ever found. But something was flying around the northern skies, and many of the witnesses concurred that whatever it was, it seemed to be looking for something. Wednesday, the 23rd of January, 1974, was just another day in Bala and the nearby villages of Corwin and Llandrillo. Just after 8:30 p.m., thousands of people in the area were jolted from their winter musings by at least one, possibly two, explosions, followed by immediately a terrible rumbling. The whole event lasted 4 or 5 seconds. Furniture moved, ornaments rattled, and buildings shook. Livestock and domestic animals voiced their terror. As people shot to their windows, some saw lights streaking across the sky. Villagers flooded out into the streets in an attempt to discover the cause of the violent disturbance. As they looked up into the mountains, several saw a mysterious white glow, lasting only a few seconds. Others saw beams of light being projected into the night sky. Many villagers immediately called the emergency services, believing that a disaster of some kind had taken place. After speaking to the police, one local nurse was certain that an aircraft had crashed and set off for the mountains in her car, dreading what she might find there, but eager to offer help until any emergency services arrived. Once above the tree line and on the high mountain road, she stopped her car, baffled and startled by what she could see. For there, high on the desolate mountainside, was what appeared to be a large, glowing sphere. Whatever it was, lay too far from the road to be reached on foot, and all the nurse could do was watch.
Maybe as a nurse we could help giving first aid. So I called to my daughters and we got into the car and we made our way up to the mountain. We drove a fair way along the mountain road and to our left we could see a huge orange ball sitting on the mountain glowing.
Yeah, we stopped and we started looking what we thought was going to be an aircraft on fire.
because we'd envisaged sort of, oh God, you know, there might be bodies if it was an aeroplane crash, and we weren't too happy at that prospect, but we were quite surprised to see this big reddish-orange ball just sitting there.
There were no flames, and it was so uniform, the shape, the round spherical shape of it made us realise we weren't looking at an aircraft. There were no flames jumping, but it was pulsating, this red orange object that we saw.
And we could see little lights, like fairy lights, coming towards the object in a zigzag pattern, and we assumed at that time possibly there was someone going to see what was what.
The sphere seemed to pulsate, changing color as it did so, from red to yellow to white, while other white lights, fairy lights as the witnesses described them, could be seen above and below it on the hillside. Realizing she could not possibly reach the lights, she drove back to her village. As she did so, a group of police and soldiers stopped her and forcefully ordered her off of the mountain, saying the road was being cordoned off. Official reaction was quick to the initial explosion. Suspiciously quick, some say, with more police and military arriving within only a few minutes, turning people away from the mountain roads. In the days following, it seems there was an unusual and large military presence in the area. Roads remained closed, and farmers reported that they were forbidden from tending to their stock. Something was obviously being sought, or why would the military jets and helicopters be crisscrossing the area and strangers combing the mountainsides? Scientists from university departments also came to tramp the hills, but far more suspicious were the official-looking outsiders who turned up in the villages immediately after the event. Tight-lipped about their business, but keenly interested in the events on the mountain. The incident was immediately taken seriously by the media, with national TV and radio reports being broadcast over several days. The Guardian, The Times, and other national newspapers gave the event in-depth coverage, as did the Welsh regional and local press. Speculation about the cause of the explosion, rumbling, and lights was rife. An aircraft crash would have accounted for the noise, lights, and keen official involvement. Indeed, one local newspaper was certain that whatever had taken place involved a crash of some kind, and that something had been retrieved from the mountains, noting, "There is a report that an army vehicle was seen coming down the mountain near Bala Lake with a large square box on the back of it and accompanied by outriders." But the authorities steadfastly refused to acknowledge that anything unusual had taken place, and in any case, not one of the explanations took into account the totality of what had been reported by witnesses. Meteorites and earth tremors were also suggested as being the cause, and indeed would have explained some of the mystery. But what could possibly explain the glows and beams of light seen up on the mountain? They were swiftly dismissed as the villagers' imaginations, shooting stars, or more ludicrously, as people out poaching hares. Natural phenomenon was also unlikely to lead to roads being closed by the army, or large areas of the mountainside being closed off. With no further information coming to light, the media soon forgot about the incident. The locals, too, let the matter fade from their immediate concern, if not entirely, from their memories. UFO researchers realized that something had taken place which had not been satisfactorily explained. Lights in the sky and mysterious explosions, together with unusual military activity, are avidly noted by the UFO community. However, in 1974, UFO crash retrievals were barely even mentioned in the UFO literature, especially in the United Kingdom, and there was no immediate template for the events in the Berwyns to fit into. Various UFO journals reported the events at the time, but no investigation was undertaken and no real conclusions were offered. But shadowy forces appeared to be at work. Within months of the event, UFO investigators in the north of England began to receive official-looking documents from a group called the Aerial Phenomenon Inquiry Network, or the APEN. These documents claimed that an extraterrestrial craft had come down on the Berwyns and was retrieved for study by the APEN, crash retrieval team, that had been on the scene within hours of the event. More significantly, the APEN claimed there had been a key witness to the UFO crash who they were recommending for hypnotic regression. If the APEN were hoaxers, then they displayed an uncanny and detailed knowledge of both ufology in general and the Berwyn Mountain incident in particular. Some researchers have speculated that the APEN may have been part of a government cover-up, using UFO mythology to spread disinformation and so divert attention from the secret weapons that were being tested. The Berwyn incident lay largely dormant throughout most of the 1970s and the 1980s, being little more than a footnote in the literature. But intriguing pieces of information did surface, later becoming part of the lore surrounding the case. Jenny Randles was a frequent visitor to the region in the late 1970s, staying in the Llandrillo area for weeks at a time. She recalls the locals speaking to her about military activity on the mountains in the wake of some form of crash-like event. Jenny was very interested in the case and initially put it down to a possible Earthlight. Paul Devereaux's book, Place of Power, he briefly relates the Berwyn incident, attributing the cause of the odd light seen on and above the mountain to geophysical stresses, known as Earth lights. Now, to ufologists, these are literally lights formed by Earth. Devereaux notes that a colleague, Keith Critchlow, was in the area several days after the incident and fell in with scientists who were investigating the mountain. They had a Geiger counter with them and allegedly gave extraordinary readings in the vicinity of a Bronze Age archaeological site on the slopes of Cater Berwyn. The 1990s brought growing interest in the UFO subject, and the Berwyn incident was recalled. Jenny Randles lectured on the case at the 1994 Fortean Times Unconvention and mentioned the anomalous radiation count at the possible crash site. Following her lecture, she was approached by a science correspondent from the Sunday Express. He mentioned rumors of a leukemia cluster among children in the Bela area, which had arisen in the years following the Berwyn incident. At the time, he connected it with possible leaks from a nearby nuclear power station, but could not prove anything. In the light of later claims of UFO crashes or secret military hardware, it could be implied that whatever had crashed had possibly been radioactive in nature and of sufficient strength to affect people in the area. By 1996, the Berwyn incident had been featured in UFO books, several UFO magazines, and national newspapers. Television programs on Channel 4 and the Discovery Channel covered the case, and by 1997, it was the focus of an entire chapter in Nick Redfern's best-selling book about the government cover-up of UFO information, titled A Covert Agenda. The Berwyn incident was big news once again. From its humble beginnings, it was now a British Roswell, just waiting to burst, firmly enshrined in UFO lore as one of the United Kingdom's few UFO crash retrieval cases. This surge of publicity brought forward new witnesses whose testimony added new and dramatic dimensions to the case. In an article for UFO Magazine, veteran ufologist Tony Dodd recounted how his anonymous informant was part of a military unit put on standby several days before the date of the Berwyn incident. His unit was moved northwards through North Wales until he and four others were sent to the village of Llandrillo to collect two large oblong boxes. They were ordered to take these to Porton Down in Wiltshire. Once at Porton Down, a UK government research establishment, the boxes were opened, and Dodd's informant told him, "We were shocked to see two creatures which had been placed inside contamination suits. When the suits were fully opened, it was obvious the creatures were clearly not of this world, and when examined, were found to be dead. What I saw in the boxes that day changed my whole concept of life." Now, Dodd's informant goes on to relate details of the creatures. He said the bodies were about 5 to 6 feet tall, humanoid in shape, but so thin they looked almost skeletal with covered skin. The military man did not actually see a crashed UFO himself, but claimed that sometime later we joined up with the other elements of our unit, who informed us that they had also transported bodies of alien beings to Porton Down, but said their cargo was still alive. So what was going on way up in the Berwyn Mountains that night? Were people seeing phantom helicopters, or were they something else? Witnesses in the villages surrounding the Berwyn Mountains reported seeing a great deal in aerial phenomenon that night. Besides the odd lights seen on the mountain itself,
There are reports, and those of the media describe at least four incandescent balls of light which streaked across the Welsh skies between 7:30 and 10 p.m. that night. These sightings have been seized upon by ufologists, with the implication being that whatever they were seeing were in fact UFOs, at least one which crashed or landed on Cater Berwyn. To the villagers of North Wales, they were UFOs literally, unidentified flying objects, and they described them in terms which make them sound highly unusual. One farmer described what he saw in these terms. He said, "I saw this object coming alongside the mountain, about the size of a bus, really, white in the middle. It came across the mountain and dipped. I thought it was going to crash." And the dramatic description, which certainly sounds like many UFO accounts, but there was a rational explanation for Farmer Williams' sighting and all the other aerial phenomena seen that evening. Records kept by the astronomy department at Leicester University, among other places, show that a number of outstanding bolide meteors were seen that night. These coincided with the approximate times given by witnesses in North Wales. The first was 7:25 p.m., followed by another at 8:15 p.m., the third at 8:30 p.m. These coincided with the centerpiece of the evening's events, and yet another, and most dramatic of all, was seen at 9:55 p.m. Bolide meteors are considerably brighter and longer-lived than ordinary shooting stars. They can appear to be very low, depending on the position of the witness, and often trail sparks of blue and green across the sky. Bolide meteors are responsible for many misperceptions of UFOs, and even fool the emergency services, who are often called out to plane crashes only to discover the witnesses had seen a bright bolide meteor. At exactly 8:38 p.m., the Bela area was rocked by a huge explosion, closely followed by a deep rumbling. Plates rattled, furniture moved, and walls rippled slightly. Some people were certain it was a plane crash on the mountains. Other older residents of the area recalled earth tremors of the past and assumed it was the latest in a series of such disturbances which have taken place along the geological rift known as the Bela Fault. This is the primary incident which has subsequently caused many UFO investigators and the readers of their books and articles to suggest that they believe that a UFO crashed. In effect, they are saying that the noise heard and the impact felt was the UFO impacting on Cater Berwyn. The crashed UFO story, however, only came out years after the event. All the time, confusion reigned as to what actually caused the impact. Because of the many reports of lights in the sky that evening, it was initially thought that a meteorite had impacted on the Berwyns. Many people across North Wales claimed to have seen a light in the sky trailing sparks, but this was seen at 8:30 p.m., 8 minutes before the explosion, and witness descriptions indicate that it was yet another bright fireball meteor. Nonetheless, in the minds of many, it has become conflated with the explosion to create the evidence of the crash. The explosion was heard only in the Bela area, but the tremor was felt as far away as Liverpool. By 2 p.m. on the 24th of January, seismologists had determined an explosion and tremor were caused by an earthquake of a 4-5 on the Richter scale. Its epicenter was the Bela area at a depth of 8 kilometers. To cause a reading of that magnitude, a solid object, a meteorite or a UFO, would have weighed several hundred tons and left a massive crater. Therefore, unless a UFO had crashed at the exact moment of an earth tremor, it can be safely assumed that the explosion and rumblings were the result of purely natural processes. As I spoke about earlier, following the explosion, Llandrillo District Nurse Pat Evans ran out into the village street. She saw no lights, but the explosion and the account of other villagers convinced her that something had crashed up on the mountain. It took her a while to get through the police as the phone lines were jammed with 999 calls, which is the same as 911 calls. But eventually she spoke to the Colwyn Bay Police Headquarters. They suggested it could have been a plane crash, so she bundled up her two young daughters into the car and set off up the mountain, intending to offer her help until the emergency services arrived. But remember, Miss Evans reached a point on the mountain, and she was unable to drive any further. That's when she saw the strange lights. She just parked there on the side of the road and observed it for a while. She said that a light drizzle was falling, but the night was otherwise clear. And Miss Evans was able to describe the ball as large and forming a perfect circle, but it didn't appear to be three-dimensional. In an interview, she recalled, there were no flames shooting or anything like that. It was very uniform, round in shape. It was a flat round. As she watched in puzzlement, the light changed color several times from red to yellow to white. Smaller lights, or fairy lights, in Miss Evans' words, could be seen nearby, but it was too far away to reach on by foot. Now, 2 days later, it was stated in the local press that police and the RAF rescue experts had come to the conclusion that a strange light seen throughout the area were due to the actions of a number of men who were out at the time hunting hares. Any link with the strange explosion was merely coincidental. RAF search team leader Sergeant Oldham said that another search of the area was unlikely to occur unless further information surfaced which attributed the lights to another source. Where the hare explanation came from is something of a mystery. Not surprisingly, it's received short shrift with the local witnesses, as can be clearly seen in the following extract taken from a letter to the Wrexham leader. Regarding your front page article, Mystery Tremor, in the issue of January 25th, I find the explanation given absolutely ludicrous. The tremors shook houses over a 60-mile radius, and the lights were seen clearly miles away. This was reported by the national press and radio. I know nothing about hare hunting, but unless the hunters use aircraft searchlights and kill their prey by lobbing small atom bombs at them, then I fail to see how anyone can accept such an explanation. So what's going on? Let's recap. Days and even weeks prior to the supposed crash-up in the Berwyn Mountains, there were several reports of phantom helicopters being seen in and around the area. Were these really helicopters? Or were they the public only thinking they were helicopters when in fact they were something otherworldly? On the night in question, there definitely were some meteors entering the Earth's atmosphere. That part cannot be argued. But several of the witnesses that night claimed that what they had witnessed were not meteorites. What they saw hung in the sky, hovered, and changed direction several times, and changed colors. There definitely was a large impact on the mountain. Now the government say it was an earthquake, but many locals and farmers in the area say it was no earthquake. Something had struck the mountainside. Most people thought it was a plane crash. If it were merely an earthquake, then why the police and military presence? Why was there an alleged search team up on the hills looking for something? What did the nurse and her daughter see? Why does everyone in the town remember many strange outsiders hanging around the area for days following the incident? Why stories of military trucks transporting strange boxes of cargo from up on the mountain? I don't know, but something strange seems afoot. Just like so many cases surrounding alleged UFO crashes from around the world, this story seems to follow the same trajectory. Was it truly an alien spacecraft that crashed up there? Or was it some sort of top secret aircraft? Or was it an amazing amount of coincidences all lining up at the exact same time? A meteorite, an earthquake, earthlights, hunters hunting for hares, and an innocent military training exercise. To me, this seems unlikely. And in the end, it's for you to decide. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Well, I have no idea what had happened. I don't think it was an earthquake somehow. You know, I still think it wasn't an earthquake.
I saw this object coming along the mountain with the size of a bus, really. It's right in the middle of the lens. Came across the mountain towards the road there. As it went over there, it dipped, and I thought it was going to crash. It dipped out of sight into the valley. Well, I'd heard so much about flying saucers, and I thought, well, this is it. And the only sound I heard of it, like a shh going through the air. I was very surprised to see it, really.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. This is another case that I didn't know too much about until I started looking into it. I heard about it once before, when I was speaking with Nick Redfern. I decided to bring it forward today because, you know, we've talked about the crash at Cape Girardeau. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Roswell numerous times. We've talked about I did the Russian crash in Downlegorsk in far eastern Russia. This is another one. This is a crash that supposedly happened in Wales. They call it the British Roswell. And basically, there's two sides to this fence. There's one side that says this was a UFO that crashed. There was numerous witnesses. People heard it. They saw it. There were strange people in town. There was things going on. Which doesn't necessarily mean it's an alien craft, mm-hmm. but something crashed up there. And then the other side of the fence is people saying, look, it was just an earthquake. What people saw in the sky that night was a meteorite. There was a meteor shower. But to me, at the end of the day, it seems like that's a bunch of coincidence. Because how could so many people mistaken a meteorite and an earthquake?
Well, what would be the odds of an earthquake hitting at the exact moment a large meteor that you could mistaken for a UFO was flying by at this exact time?
Exactly right.
You know what I'm saying? I don't know what happened there, but it just does seem a little funny. Like, if you're going to blame it on that.
Well, and if they said that you could feel the blast 60 miles away. So if a giant meteorite hit the mountain, mm-hmm. don't you think that even today you'd be able to go up on that mountain and find some kind of mark where it hit? There'd be pieces of the meteorite everywhere?
Yes.
But there's nothing there.
Yeah.
So I think that the government did show up, and I think they did carry off whatever happened. Now, that doesn't mean it was alien. Maybe it was a top-secret aircraft that crashed. But there was numerous people that said they saw it, and it was changing colors. It was a sphere-like thing. One person said that it didn't crash, that it looked like it made a safe landing. You know, and then the nurse and her daughters, they went up on the hill because they thought an airplane crashed. They were like, crap, we better get up there to mm-hmm. help out, like a first responder. And they were turned away by the military. There's like, turn around, get out of here, don't come around.
Yeah.
And then they were like, I could see people looking around there. And the story, no, that wasn't search and rescue. That was guys that were out hunting hares. You know, what do they call it? Hare coursing. They were, there's guys that they're hunting for rabbits. And they're like, that's not what I saw.
Yeah.
You know, and then there was the guys that came forward that actually were in the military. And they said, we boxed up these alien bodies and took them to Porton Down. Just like our Hangar 18 or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, you know?
Yeah.
Same kind of funny, right? It's very similar to the Roswell crash. Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's up to you to decide if you think it's real or not. If you want to check into it, I'll put links to it in the show notes. Or you can just do a Google search. It's pretty easy to find.
It's pretty wild.
What, you said you had a crazy story?
Well, I've got something awesome that you're going to enjoy right here.
Okay.
We've been getting prepared and stuff for the summer because we got a lot of trips coming up as far as camping and kayaking and trips like this. But those of you that have not listened to an interview on Joe Rogan's podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience, and you want to listen to something interesting, go look up the interview with Alex Honnold. Alex Honnold's a young free climber.
Mm-hmm.
Great interview, great guy, the whole thing. I bring it up because he just completed the most dangerous rope-free ascent ever.
Yeah, that guy, that's the guy that you always see that doesn't use ropes, right?
Exactly.
He just freehands everything.
Freehands everything. National Geographic just covered this. This took place at Yosemite National Park there in California. It says, renowned rock climber Alex Honnold, this past Saturday, folks, became the first person to scale the iconic nearly 3,000-foot granite wall known as El Capitan without using ropes or other safety gear.
Man, I've watched numerous videos of him. You could check him out on YouTube, too. I mean, they're HD quality.
Yes.
Videos. It makes me nauseous just watching it. He talks about several times where he's like, he'll get tired halfway up and he has to stop and rest. And it's one of those things I never really thought about. He's like, once you get to a certain part, you can't come back down. You have to finish. Once you've started,
you have to finish.
The only way
or
to finish
you're gonna
is
fall.
Go up. You can't come. You can't reverse yourself.
Yeah.
And he just acts like it's no big deal. I mean, I remember one story. He said he was halfway up and realized he didn't have any chalk with.
Had to borrow some on the way up.
I mean, like, who does that? It's a matter of time before this guy's dead, right?
Oh yeah, and he knows it. He knows it. They say right now that this is maybe the greatest feat of pure rock climbing in the history of the sport. Said he ascended the peak in 3 hours, 56 minutes, taking the final moderate pitch at a near run. Says at 9:28 a.m. under the blue sky and a few wisps of clouds, he pulled his body over the rocky lip of the summit and stood on the sandy ledge the size of a child's bedroom. Now, he began ropeless, free soloing is what it's called, folks, at 5:32 that morning. That's whenever he started it. He got up and took off. This is what the greatest thing is how he says how he was dressed. He had his favorite red t-shirt on and cut-off nylon pants and had eaten his favorite standard breakfast of oats, flax, chia seeds, blueberries before driving to the El Capitan Meadow. And then he took off of it. Said he parked his van, hiked that way, pulled on a pair of sticky-soled climbing shoes. I put on his bag of chalk. This time he didn't forget that. Got his hands dry, found his first toehold, and took off. Says for more than a year, Honnold's been training for the climb at locations in the U.S., China, Europe, and Morocco. And a small circle of friends and fellow climbers who knew about the project had been sworn to secrecy. That says this, that a team of filmmakers led by Jimmy Chin, which is one of Honnold's longtime climbing partners, captured the ascent for an upcoming Nat Geo documentary film feature.
Wow, yeah, he's a great photographer too, Jimmy Chin.
Yes.
Have you ever seen the documentary Meru? M-E-R-U?
Yes, I believe
it's
so.
It's on Showtime, I believe. That's a very good documentary. I know where I saw Alex one time. It was on 60 Minute Sports. Have you ever seen that guy's fingers?
Yes. They look like frog fingers, the way they're fat on the ends.
Dude, they're super, because he uses so much of his weight.
It makes your fingers.
The strongest fingers in the world.
But I mean, they say that it makes it. It smashes them out and makes it like that. Yeah.
It makes my stomach turn. I'm not scared of heights, but I can't imagine being on a cliff wall like that.
So he pulled it off, man. He pulled it off, knocked it out of the park, literally, with that climb. Soloed it. So, for all of us sitting around going, man, I wish I didn't have to get up and mow the yard and all that stuff. Look what this guy's doing.
That's insane.
And he's only 31. 31.
I don't think he's going to be around much longer.
You don't know if he'll make 41?
No.
I don't know if this is something that you retire from, is it?
I don't know.
Or do they just bury you? They're just like, eh.
What about like life insurance? I mean, when they ask you your occupation, I mean, how much his premiums must be?
Man, there's no way. He takes great care of himself, but it is one of those things that I liked this right here. They said that he's obsessive about his training. And it's an hour-long session every day, hanging by his fingertips and doing one and two-arm pull-ups that he's made on this apparatus that he bolts to the door. So he just holds it on his van because he lives in a van.
Yeah, that's right. Down by the river.
And
he takes his training seriously. You kind of have to, because if you mess up, you're dead.
Yeah.
It's not like, I'm going to skip running bleachers today. You know, if it doesn't work out, we might lose the football game. Yeah. I mean, if it doesn't work, you're dead.
If it doesn't work, you fall the 3,000 foot to the bottom.
Yeah.
That's what happens because you didn't do your chin-ups.
Man.
So, yeah. So, Alex Honnold, man, my hat's off to you, sir. That is awesome. I can't wait to see it now because, like I said, I got hung up on that dude when I listened to the interview, and then it was just one of those things that led to another. So, I'm just like, man, I need to do something with my life. Like I've told you, we got some trips planned, and I've got some stuff in the works before. So, when I retire, I got some big trips I'm going to go do.
You ever see those videos of those kids climbing those buildings like in Russia and stuff?
Yes.
Like, what is wrong
with
them?
And doing like cartwheels and jumping, or like they're riding skateboards along the side of it and all that
hanging
stuff.
Hanging by one arm. I mean, and they're so hyped. There's clouds are below them.
Yeah.
What is wrong with people? Well, before we get out of here, let's talk about our sponsor. That's Gaia, GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Don't forget, you can go over there and sign up. That they have an awesome video streaming service with over 7,000 titles, and it's awesome. I love all their stuff, especially Deep Space, Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe, tons of documentaries, and it's only 99 cents now if you sign up for your first month. They have other plans too, like a 3-month plan is $20, or they have an annual plan that's about $95.40, and you can watch all this stuff. I love it. If you like Expanded Perspectives, you're going to like Gaia. They have a section on yoga. They have a section on transformation. They have films, documentaries. Seeking Truth is my favorite. They have ancient origins, secrets in government cover-ups, metaphysics. And then they have the paranormal and unexplained, like cosmic disclosure and other things with George Norrie. It's an amazing service. I suggest you go over there. And if you want to sign up, you have to go to our link. That's Gaia.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. And then by them sponsoring us, they allow us to keep bringing you this show for absolutely free. I mean, it's free to you, but unfortunately, it's not free for us to produce this show. There's data storage. There's all types of things that go into it. I don't want to go into that right now. Also, don't forget, if you like Expanded Perspectives, write us and rate us a review on iTunes. You can email your stories to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can always call us 817-945-3828. And if you want more Expanded Perspectives, don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, and sign up. It's only $5 a month. You can go through PayPal, and you'll get an additional episode every Friday, as well as access to the entire back catalog. And there's lots of subjects we cover over there that we don't cover on this show. So you really need to get over there. If you're wondering, I don't know if I'd like it or not, it's exactly the same as Expanded Perspectives. They're about an hour long,
same types of stuff. There's no advertising on those shows. Sometimes we curse, you know, because they're not re-aired on radio. But go over there, folks. Check it out today. Cam, you got any plans for their week?
Hard work and clean living, baby. That's what I got planned. Maybe a little disc golf, weather permitting, and that's about it.
That's about me, too, man. I got just regular work and baseball practice and things like that. I think it's supposed to rain most of the week. I'm not hating on that too bad.
Nah.
Everybody be out careful out there, especially you folks out in London, man. It seems to be going mad out there.
Yeah, y'all be careful. Take care of yourselves.
Right? Please be careful. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.